Welcome back. So tonight we're going to circle back on the subject of Buddhist ethical precepts. And many of you were here when we heard a very engaging talk a couple of weeks ago. And I know that a number of folks, I think some of the folks in the room, are also involved in a new class on the Buddhist precepts and climate change. So I'm going to take one more dive based on what's on my mind about the precepts. And my plan is that I'll talk for a while, maybe about half the time, plant some seeds for group conversation. And we'll record my talk, and then we will turn off the recording for the group conversation and question and answer. I just want you to feel completely free to converse without feeling that anything you say is on the internet forever after. So a Dharma friend and I had coffee earlier this week, and we ended up chewing on a phrase that we've heard repeatedly over the last several years. The idea that the Buddhist ethical precepts are not commandments. And you know, this is almost a truism in the insight meditation community. And to be completely transparent, I've given Dharma talks here and I've said this, you know, the precepts are not commandments. But as my friend and I talked, we found ourselves not so sure either about what it means or about whether we actually agreed. And that led to tonight's talk. So since Dharma talks have to have titles, I called it Buddhist Ethical Precepts. Are they really not commandments? And I honestly don't expect to answer this question, but I'll toss out some perspectives and then we can talk. And my real intention is to make room for each of us to explore what rings true in our own practice, not to presume that there actually is an answer. So for context, and to make sure that the people who have only been here two or three times and the people who have been coming for 15 years are all on the same page, before I really get into my own content, I'm going to do a quick review of the five precepts and their place in the Buddhist Eightfold Path, which is really the whole Buddhist path of practice. So just skipping lightly through the Eightfold Path, the first two folds relate to training in wisdom and understanding, wise view, especially an understanding of how our intentions and actions lead us toward or away from suffering or a sense of unsatisfactoriness, and wise intention, which is the intention not to harm, the intention to be free from ill will, and the intention toward renunciation, meaning letting go of wanting, aversion, and confusion, or as we sometimes call them, greed, hatred, and delusion. The next three folds of the Eightfold Path relate to training in ethical conduct, wise speech, wise action, and wise livelihood. And this folds in the precepts. And the final three folds relate to training in meditation and how we train the mind toward awareness and steadiness. And these are wise effort, wise mindfulness or awareness, sati, and wise samadhi, meaning steadiness of mind, collectedness. And as those of us who have come for the last 20 years know, and perhaps those who have come for the last 3 weeks know, these are not eight different practices. Basically, it's one integrated path. And the focus of the path is the freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion that arises when we understand deeply how our intentions and actions take us into suffering or help release us from suffering. So within that Eightfold Path, I want to just give a very quick review of the ethical precepts. And We're talking here about the five lay ethical precepts. And what we mean by lay precepts is that these are the precepts within Buddhist traditions that apply to non-monastic people, householders, like most or all of us are. So the five precepts: refraining from taking life. This is also understood to mean refraining from injuring. So classically, to be crosswise with this precept, you need to perceive that there's a living being that has breath and consciousness. You need to have an actual volition, a will, to kill or injure the living being. And you have to actually take action to kill or injure the living being. And that would, of course, include telling someone else to do it. The second precept, refraining from taking what's not given, meaning intentionally taking something from another person who owns it legally and blamelessly. Again, this is the classical understanding. Refraining from sexual misconduct. Refraining from false speech. The precept says false speech. But in the Buddhist texts and in the Buddhist tradition, wise speech actually includes refraining from four things: lying, malicious or divisive speech, harsh or abusive speech, and idle chatter. And wise speech is also understood to include five positive aspects: that speech is true, kind, beneficial, it's spoken for a beneficial purpose, to confer a benefit; timely, meaning it's spoken at a time and in a way that the intended audience can hear it; and motivated by love, motivated by kindness. And the final precept is refraining from intoxicants. And contemporary Western teachers actually differ about whether this precept refers to all consumption of intoxicants or whether the meaning is about avoiding intoxication and heedlessness. So now we're all on the same page, and I want to jump into the meat of tonight's topic. You know, the question I'm really asking myself a little more seriously: are the precepts really not commandments? What does this even mean? And what difference does it make if we answer yes or no? And in this talk, I'm drawing heavily on an essay by Gil Fronsdahl called Virtues Without Rules. You have a link to the essay in your handout. I recommend it very highly. Gil is the co-guiding teacher at Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City and quite a scholar. So in starting out on this topic, I want to acknowledge something that we don't always talk about, which is that in the Theravadan Buddhist tradition, which is the Asian tradition that is part of this community's Buddhist lineage, there actually are very strict, specific rules of ethical conduct. And in this tradition, that adherence to these rules is driven by a cosmology that centers around accumulating merit for the sake of future births. Now, this is a cosmology which some Westerners embrace and some Westerners don't. All of them very serious Buddhists. But it is interwoven into traditional Theravadan Buddhism. And the monastics, the Theravadan monastics, lived and still live by an extensive code of conduct, many more precepts than five. For Buddhist lay people in South Asia, the teachings on virtuous conduct have been central. Traditionally, meditation has been more for monastics. And the emphasis in the ethical teachings, or the teachings on virtue for lay people, has really been, again, traditionally on making merit for future lives. And even for monastics who do train heavily in meditation, the ethical training, the training in ethics, comes before meditation. So I want to read a snippet from Bhikkhu Bodhi, who is a contemporary American Theravadan monk and a very renowned scholar. And he's writing, this is from a book he's written on the precepts. And he says the Pali word, Pali is the ancient language in which we think many of the Buddha's teachings were first transcribed. And he says the Pali word for moral discipline, sila, has three levels of meaning. One, inner virtue, i.e. endowment with such qualities as kindness, contentment, simplicity, truthfulness, patience, etc. Two, virtuous actions of body and speech, which express those inner virtues outwardly. In other words, kind of a natural expression of virtue. And three, rules of conduct, governing actions of body and speech, designed to bring them into accord with the ethical ideals. So Bhikkhu Bodhi takes it for granted that sila, the precepts, is about rules of conduct. So when did the precepts stop being mandatory, if they stopped being mandatory? According to Gil Fronsdal, this came from the contemporary Western teachers who founded the insight meditation or Vipassana movement. And these teachers and some of their teachers in Asia were true pioneers in creating a movement in which meditation is fully available to lay practitioners. I mean, we are the beneficiaries, the direct beneficiaries of that, not just monastics, and a movement in which, especially in its early days, in the late 20th century, meditation has been the primary focus of practice. Again, remember that in Asia, you trained in ethics first. You didn't just say, I want to go to a meditation center. So here's an interesting quote from Gill. He says, in bringing this meditation practice to the West, the founders of the insight meditation movement have consciously downplayed or even jettisoned many important elements of the Theravada tradition, including monasticism, rituals, merit-making, and Buddhist cosmology. Without these and other elements, the insight meditation movement has been relatively unencumbered in developing itself into a form of Western Buddhism. In doing so, it has retained only a minimal identification with its Theravada origins. My sense of the tone of this passage and of the entire essay is not that he's saying this is bad or good. He's just giving us some context and some information that we don't often hear. I want to be clear that Western teachers within this movement have always spoken about the importance of ethical conduct. I'm not saying, and in no way is Gill saying, that they've jettisoned ethics, but they've tended to talk about the precepts as guidelines rather than as rules. Western teachers have tended to stress the way ethical behavior affects the quality of our mental experience and how that affects our ability to practice, as well as the impact of our behavior on others. So you've often heard, you know, the very deep sentiment that when we behave ethically, we are giving ourselves and others a great gift of safety. Another frequent theme in Western teaching is the idea that virtuous behavior is a natural outgrowth of inner cultivation, our meditation. The idea that as we shed greed, hatred, and delusion, we naturally want to behave harmlessly. And I think if we look at our own practice, you know, many of us have at least experienced moments where that's so, where we cling less fiercely, where we're able to take a larger view, where we're able to bring more kindness to a situation. So the idea that that's where our ethical behavior comes from. But Gill says something very interesting. He says, in relying on meditation as the means to ethical transformation, the insight meditation movement can be seen as reversing the traditional Theravada training sequence of ethics, meditation, and wisdom. So to give you a really salient example, Christopher Titmuss, who is a contemporary lay British Buddhist teacher and a former Theravada monk, says this. He says, there is a difference between an ethical training and abiding by commandments. A major authority will impose commandments upon us. We either believe them or we don't. And there is a lack of opportunity to inquire into their relevance. He goes on to say, religious baggage also accompanies commandments. No judgment there. They cannot be separated from the book, the prophet, or the savior. Morality is of a different order. The outcome may be the same, but the attitude is very different. The five precepts or ethical guidelines are a training in inner discipline. The training, therefore, is not a series of thou shalt nots, but a code of practice. I don't know, am I the only one who detects a little bit of attitude in that? So let's look at some of the ways in which it is fair to say that the precepts are not commandments. Precept practice has always been understood to be a training. You know, there's a formula when we take the precepts, when we say the precepts, when we chant the precepts. There's a formula. We say the thing we're abstaining from, and we basically say, I undertake the training step. That's the real translation, to refrain from. The word sikapadam, which you have in the phrase, for example, the first precept is panatipata veramani sikapadam samadhiyami. And sikapadam means a training step. So I am undertaking a training step. We're voluntarily choosing to take this on as a training. And it actually works as a training. We might even analogize it to an athletic training. Engaging with the precepts as a training conditions or can condition the mind and the heart in the direction of non-harming. And basically, we're training voluntarily to keep ethical aspirations at the forefront of our awareness. So when I say training, I mean something very practical. I mean, for example, reciting the precepts daily, aloud or silently, chanting, listening to Dharma talks about the precepts, reading, talking with Dharma friends. Basically, all these different ways of keeping the precepts in front of our faces and engaging with the precepts in neutral situations, not just when our lives have heated up. And I think this does provide a powerful set of reference points that can often jog our awareness back toward our non-harming intentions, which are also called ahimsa, non-harming, or can help us see our harmful motivations when they arise. And as we do this conditioning, it really becomes more intuitive. So just a couple of notes, examples about how this functions in my practice. I do recite the precepts to myself daily, silently, not aloud. I've done this for quite a few years now. And I recite them slowly and reflectively, giving it enough time that if anything has to bubble up from my subconscious, there's anything that I might have to deal with about the precepts in my actual life, it perhaps may come to my attention. And over time, you know, just doing this year after year, I have found that at times the precepts will pop into my awareness if I'm wading into territory where there might be an issue. So recently, I encountered a situation where I felt a strong need to talk to a couple of friends about a third person. And I knew that what I was going to say when I talked to my friends had the potential to diminish that person in my friend's eyes. And actually, my conscious motivation was to use my friends, whom I consider to be ethical, wise people, as a sounding board about a situation I was in. And ultimately, I decided that this was appropriate. But the interesting thing is that several years of daily practice with the precepts has conditioned my mind so that at least much of the time, I can't talk about a third person without a little light going on. And you know, there is no precept that says you can't talk about a third person, but it is an area of speech where you may want to ask questions about what you're doing. So, you know, we often talk about practicing before, during, or after we act. In this case, there was like a slight catch in my mind, a slight hesitation, kind of just a little feeling of pausing in the mind and the body that let me look at my motivations as I was starting to speak. And then I did go ahead, and I feel fine about it. I've also spoken here, given a Dharma talk a few months ago about working and struggling with wise speech when I talk to anonymous customer service folks. I think a number of you were here. I'm still struggling with it. I'm still practicing with it. So this morning I had a question about my printer, and I called customer service. And I asked my question, which I thought was fairly straightforward. And then the customer service rep asked me something that I had just explained. And I immediately heard myself saying something like, "That's what I just said." And you know, there was a slight edge. I wasn't nasty. You know, it was maybe a 2 out, you know, on a scale of 0 to 10. But I was definitely irritated. And definitely when I heard myself, when I felt myself heating up, it wasn't in keeping with my deeper desire, you know, not to make this person's day worse. And in this particular situation, I didn't catch the aversion in my mind and body until after I spoke. So this is practicing after. But as soon as I spoke, I recognized the harshness, and I was able to dial it back for the rest of the call. So I think there was at least some conditioning to know, yeah, I step over the edge, but I don't actually want to, and it doesn't make me happier. And there's some self-correction. So another reason we might want to say that the precepts are not commandments or absolutes is that in some circumstances, it's actually impossible to fulfill the literal terms of a precept and simultaneously live up to the intention of non-harming that connects all the precepts. And the classic example that, you know, many of you have heard and that you heard 2 weeks ago is, would you lie to the Nazis to prevent harm, to prevent death? And I hope the answer is a very clear and unambiguous yes. But I also am asking myself, how rare are the situations where non-harming actually requires a lie? Because when we give an example, we give an example that's that extreme. So this is an open question that I'm sitting with and that I'm throwing out for your consideration. So in addition, we're still on the maybe they're not commandments. Life situations are complex. You know, it's impossible to have an ethical cookbook. For most situations that come up in my life, I cannot turn to page 5 of some book and look up what I'm supposed to do. So for example, how do I know if my motivation for speaking is divisive? Going back to my previous example about consulting friends about a third person. Really by my own discernment, if it is discernment, about the whole context. How do I know if chit-chat is idle speech or is speech that helps establish a base of goodwill with my fellow humans? So, you know, what about the Game of Thrones finale? You know, or I'm on the grocery line and the clerk says to another person who's passing by, like, how about the game? And somehow they always know what game they're talking about. I'm very impressed. You know, do I have the right to call that chit-chat just because I don't even know what game it is? Or, you know, is this, again, it's context, right? There isn't any one answer. It's something we have to answer for ourselves. So how do I know if I'm engaged in harsh speech? Is it just my tone of voice, my words, my choice of words, what I can discern about my motivation? Am I being harsh in a given situation or just emphatic? And who decides? Which I think is a particular issue for many women in our culture and in many cultures. Who decides if I'm being harsh? Are there urgent situations in which I need to raise my voice to prevent harm? How do I tell the difference between the situation in which telling the truth would truly cause harm and the situation where my impulse is to fudge the truth as a way of dodging my own discomfort? We could do a whole Dharma talk on that. Okay, so now let's look at some of the ways that the precepts do function as rules, if not commandments. First of all, the precepts, I think, very obviously describe shared expectation about normative behavior that's considered non-harmful. I mean, how optional is not killing and not stealing? And especially in more complex or subtle areas like speech, you know, we do know that we will fall short and that we'll get to explore what happens when we fall short. But that doesn't mean that there isn't a shared understanding about a minimum standard of conduct. So in addition, going back to the idea of the precepts as a training, at least in my own practice, I don't see how I can use the precepts as a form of training or reflection without knowing and really reflecting on the ins and outs of the rule book. I mean, the precepts do work as powerful touchstones for evaluating balance and imbalance in our minds. But I think it's hard to work with them seriously as a training or a touchstone if we don't engage with the specific meaning of each precept. We have to know them. So the example I gave before, the opportunity to reflect on whether having a particular conversation would constitute divisive speech, having that reflection, whether or not I made the right decision. I mean, I don't know. I believe I did, but who knows, right? But being able to even reflect about that depended on my having cultivated familiarity with the different aspects of wise speech. And then the question popped up at an appropriate time in my daily life. And, you know, this was a situation in which reminding myself of the precepts again and again over time made them part of my intuitive apparatus. But sometimes the precepts, I think, work differently. Sometimes knowing the rule book is helpful when things aren't that intuitive, you know, when it's more of even an intellectual or conceptual inquiry. So to give another example, in my own practice, for a number of years, I have been reflecting on my willingness to consume dead animals. So I'm not a vegetarian right now. And I would prefer not to be a predator to any living being. Right now, I acknowledge that this is more theoretical than intuitive for me. I don't yet feel it in my gut. But it's been interesting to reflect, you know, consciously and conceptually on the first precept, not taking life, and on the different parts of that precept. So remembering what I said before, that the precept is understood to involve the perception that there's a living being, a motivation to take the being's life, and a conscious action to end the life of the living being. At one point, I would have said that buying food at the grocery store doesn't involve any of this. You know, it might not be a good thing, but I'm not consciously trying to take the life of the living being. I'm just going to the grocery store. Well, I don't feel that way anymore. I mean, now I really, looking at the same precept and reflecting on the different pieces, I have to ask myself, as a consumer, is my purchasing meat not an implicit request or a demand that animals be killed? And the point here, in this, for purposes of this Dharma talk, is not whether eating meat is good, bad, or indifferent, but how reflecting on a precept, on the actual elements of the precept in its detail, can be useful even if the precept is not yet intuitively embedded in us. So these are different ways that we can use the precepts taking them as rules of conduct. I think the precepts are brilliantly designed to address areas where we humans are likely to become confused. So with this in mind, I want to go back to an idea that I mentioned earlier, the idea that is often discussed in Western meditation circles, that ethical behavior is the natural outflowing of the awakened heart, you know, the natural consequence of our practice. And from this perspective, I think you could say that the formal precepts are like training wheels that perhaps we don't need so much as our heart awakens. It's been framed that way sometimes. But my question is, you know, how long do we actually need the training wheels? So my sense of this path of practice is that we spend a lot of time finding, seeing, recognizing the ways we get caught by greed, hatred, and delusion, wanting, aversion, and confusion. And when we recognize ourselves getting caught, what we're recognizing is that we're not seeing clearly. We're catching ourselves not seeing clearly. And of course, every moment in which we wake up to our own confusion is a moment of freedom. But often the clear seeing happens after the fact. It certainly does in my life. So until we're fully enlightened, are we really ready to drop the training wheels? I can say for myself that I'm not. I need those training wheels. So this doesn't mean that we don't have the freedom and even the responsibility to grapple with what's right in any given situation and to make our own decisions. I think we have to do that. But having an engaged relationship with the rule book, you know, really making the precepts part of our equipment is a powerful and important part of our training. So finally, before we transition to the group conversation, the elephant in the room, or at least one elephant in the room. So as I think we saw in the quotation from Christopher Titmus, the Buddhist lay teacher, when contemporary Buddhists say that the precepts are a code of practice rather than commandments, I think there's an obvious comparison, either explicit or implicit, to other spiritual traditions. You know, the traditions that have a creator God that speaks commandments from a mountaintop amidst smoke and thunder. And I think framing it this way, what we have are, you know, rules of training, not commandments. I think this seems to imply that Buddhist practice is a training and an exploration, whereas other traditions require blind and unreflective obedience. And honestly, the more I've thought about this, I think this may be in part an exercise in branding. So, you know, thinking about the history, the contemporary Western Buddhists who brought this back from Asia in the 1960s and 1970s were addressing people, including themselves, who were disenchanted with organized religion as they knew it. So, you know, come over to our side. We're doing something cooler, better. But as many of us who practice in more than one spiritual tradition know, and I'm speaking as someone who's a practicing Jew and a serious Buddhist practitioner, this comparison really discounts the degree to which many different non-Buddhist religious traditions also ask practitioners to grapple with complex situational ethics and to explore the motivations and the psychology behind their actions. So with that, we have almost a half hour available to us for group conversation. And my question for you all before we turn off the recording is how you work with the precepts. Because again, this is about each of us finding our way with what feels right to us, how you work with the precepts and how you regard them as rules, commandments, guidelines, or something completely different. How do you articulate this to yourself? And how does this affect your practice? So with that, let's turn off the recorder.